This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. You can join our conversation, as always, at WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. If you want to call us in, you can do it at 860-275-7266. That's 860-275-7266. The cameras of CTN, the Connecticut Network, are here with us today. Also with us, as always, is Colin McEnroe. He's the host of The Colin McEnroe Show here on Connecticut Public Radio. Howdy, Colin.
Good morning, Mr. Dankosky.
With us also is Christine Stewart, editor-in-chief of CTNewsJunkie.com. Hello, Christine.
Hello.
And Mark Pazniokas, Capital Bureau Chief at The Connecticut Mirror. Hello there, Paz.
Good morning.
And go Sox. Paz just got in from a very late night watching the first game of the World Series. Maybe we'll talk about that later on.
Listeners, please grade me on a curve.
I know. So we are going to be discussing the governor's race and some interesting things that have happened here in just the last couple moments around the governor's race in just a bit. But let's start talking about the state legislature. After gaining ground in the last few election cycles, Republicans may be on the verge of capturing majorities in the House and Senate for the first time in more than two decades. The GOP is working pretty hard at this, Colin. And it's something we haven't spent a whole lot of time talking about, but it could be as important, maybe more important than what happens in the governor's race.
Well, I don't know if it's more important, but it certainly is. I mean, there are kind of only two mysteries in the election in this state, probably anyway, and that's who's going to be governor and then who's going to control the two chambers of the legislature. The under ticket, you know, it doesn't really seem like there's going to be too many surprises there. The congressional races seem pretty predictable, but this is a very unpredictable thing, and it's very close. And one thing that we know is that these races are hard to predict, because just a few votes, a few hundred votes, a few dozen votes sometimes can make a big difference. And there's kind of no room for surprises, too. Each side, particularly in the Senate, each side really kind of needs to, you know, draw an inside straight, or I don't really know poker terms, but something like that, right?
So, something good.
Yeah. So Christine and Paz, I think, will have much more expert knowledge of all this stuff. But I've been doing a lot of talking over the last week to anybody who will talk to me about this. And it does seem as though there are some surprises that we already know about. Startlingly, Tony Boucher, who's a long-time serving Republican senator in kind of the New Canaan area, seems to be in a very tough race with a 21-year-old challenger named Will Haskell, who is, I think, had like 150 meet-and-greet events. And they're just door-knocking, you know, in a way that people who live there have never seen before. Mike McLaughlin, who's also a fairly longtime senator from the Danbury area, is in a very tough race with a woman named Julie Kushner. You know, these are seats I wouldn't have guessed would be in play. But you know, there are other seats which the Republicans, those are two seats the Republicans could lose. They can also pick up seats. The old Ted Kennedy seat. There's a former baseball player with a pretty interesting backstory, Adam Greenberg, who's running there as a Republican. They may pick up that one. So I think one of the things we're probably looking at is kind of some, it's not as though one seat is going to move and create a 1917 split. I think a lot of seats might jump back and forth, and at the end of the night, we'll just add up the check and see, you know, who's got it.
Christine?
Yeah, and there's also, I guess you can see which races they're targeting for the most part based on the amount of outside spending that's happening for some of these races. We have open seats, so Paul Doyle decided not to run again for re-election, so there's an open seat there, and Representative Matt Lesser is running for that seat. There's a lot of outside money going to that race. We also have Senator Steve Cassano out in Manchester. There's a lot of outside money targeting that race, too, because his race was close last time. And then we have the seat that Art Linares is giving up in the 33rd District between Representative Melissa Gebron and Norm Needleman, who's the first selectman of Essex down there. So there's a lot of close races happening.
And are people pouring money into these races, Paz?
Well, in the open seat, the open race for Art Linares's seat down there. I mean, Norm Needleman is putting in his own money. He's put in like $350,000 of his own money. He just dropped another $100,000 in there. So, you know, that's a lot of money for a state senate race.
The outside spending in that race is pretty significant too. It's topping, you know.
It is, and that one
$60,000.
The outside spending, I mean, some of it is they're just using sort of the basic manual. They seem to be looking at open seats. Steve Cassano in Manchester has been a target for several cycles. People keep writing him off. He's now in his 70s. He's got a bad knee. I don't know how much door-to-door stuff he does anymore, but he is very, very well known. In fact, my first job in journalism, I covered him on what is, you know, basically the town council in Manchester, and that was, well, a long time
ago. Right after the American Civil War ended.
Yes. It was a long time
ago. So you, just to go back to Steve Cassano, this is kind of an interesting race. Yeah, he's 76 years old, had some pretty significant leg problems, and it seemed like he wasn't going to run. And it even appeared that Dennis Shane, who many of us have known not only as a spokesperson for DEEP, but, I mean, we're going way back, he was, I think, spokesman for the Senate majority or for Joe Lieberman or something when he was a state senator or something. I mean, we've all known Dennis a really long time. It looked as though Dennis might be jumping into that race because Cassano wasn't going to
run. He also
run.
Was a reporter at the Journal Inquirer when I was there.
So, like, Dennis is, I don't know. So that would have been really interesting, you know, for, but anyway, that didn't happen. Cassano ultimately decided.
I would have been conflicted because I helped him move once and I demanded he return the favor 2 years later.
Oh, and so did he not do it?
No, he did. No, no. For the record, he showed up.
I'm going to interrupt this edition of Connecticut Journalism History for just a moment and let Colin finish his thought.
So one thing about – so that's an interesting area too. And we should say Mark Tweedy is running against Cassano. Tweedy's a guy trying to move up from the House to the Senate. Glastonbury is weird because Glastonbury used to be kind of a Republican – you know, reliability Republican town. In the last municipal election, the council flipped from a Republican supermajority to, I believe, a Democratic majority. So that makes you, you know, there's a lot of talk, as Paz said, that, you know, maybe this is the year they take Cassano out and he's getting old and he can't, you know. On the other hand, you know, the numbers might actually work from him. And it's a strange district because you've got Glastonbury, which is a kind of Tony bedroom community, but a pretty big chunk of Manchester, which is, you know, is socioeconomically maybe a little bit different too.
And that gets into the underlying trends. And there are conflicting trends here. You have the potential blue wave. You have the importance of suburban women voters. I mean, every pollster, every analyst says these are the folks who are going to determine the elections in Connecticut and a lot of other places. And then on the flip side, you have a lot of dissatisfaction with the outgoing Democratic governor, Dan Malloy, as well as the general direction of Connecticut when it comes to anything having to do with money.
Yeah, and in incumbents in general.
Yeah, and then you have just the candidates themselves. I mean, right. I wouldn't say that Representative Mark Tweedy is any sort of, you know, rabid conservative. You know, so I think that people who know him in the district, it may play differently for them.
No, absolutely. And the interesting thing, when we try to analyze these trends, these big movements that are happening, the thing that we have been taught in Connecticut over and over again is that there is a disconnection at the bottom of the ballot and at the top of the ballot. And what I mean is the Democrats have won at the top of the ballot every year since, you know, well, anyway, the Republicans have picked up legislative seats in every year since 2010, except 2012, when they held their own in a presidential year, which is pretty damn good, despite not doing anything at the top of the ticket. So what do we take from that? What do we take from that is that coattails don't mean what they used to mean, and that the closer you get to the people, state House, state Senate, the better chance you have to win or lose on your own merits. Now, the flip side is, if there are a whole bunch of suburban women turning out because they are angry at the president and angry at Congress, that is going to change the mix.
And Connecticut has just a long history of ticket splitting. I mean, it's just, you know, people don't vote the party line in Connecticut.
And the unaffiliated voters say in focus groups that they like a divided government, too. So they're pretty comfortable voting for a Democrat at the top line and switching to Republican.
But do you go to the polls, though, in order to do that? I mean, are you thinking that in your mind, that it would be good if we had split government, but then when you get into the ballot box or whatever it looks like now, do you actually, you know, take a look and say, well, I like this person who's my representative, or I like this challenger? You're not really necessarily thinking about splitting the ticket all the way down the ballot.
Right. It's not as though people go to the ballot in Canton and go, well, I really want it to be a 1917 split in the Senate, blah, blah, blah. But there is a little bit more fluidity. I think it's important to emphasize what the panel is saying here, which is that we could have a night where there's this huge blue outraged turnout that's heavily driven by women, in which case, instead of sitting here with our Tim Russert dry erase boards trying to figure out whether Len Fasano can possibly become the leader of the Senate, it's going to be a blowout. And you might see somebody surprising get taken off the board. You know, it could be like even a Kevin Witka, speaking of Canton, running against Melissa Osborne. You could see something like that, something that we ordinarily wouldn't expect. But the other possibility is that, you know, these valences are kind of strong, equally strong, in which case, yeah, for the Senate at the end of the night, we might be looking at that race down there in the Essex area as the one that tips it one way or another or keeps it tied.
Tony Boucher and Will Haskell, I think, are that race is interesting in that, you know, Tony Boucher, who's been around for a while, she's a moderate Republican by many measures, but she had an exploratory campaign for governor. And when you are exploring running statewide as a Republican right now, you've got to say some things that don't play well in her district. Her district goes over to Westport. It's part of Connecticut that is traditionally Republican that did not vote for Donald Trump.
Right.
And so Tony was in an interesting spot of trying to be with the rest of the candidates and being reasonably supportive of Donald Trump, and that would help her in a statewide Republican primary, not as much in a race for state Senate in that district.
I think voters sometimes make you pay also for having ambitions other than the ones right there in your town, too. And if they feel you've got your eyes on some other prize. I mean, 16 years ago, Jesse Stratton thought she was going to be Speaker of the House.
That's true.
She
Majority Leader, yeah.
Yes.
No Speaker, I think.
She was going to take down Moira
Lyons and be Speaker of the House, and instead she lost her state rep seat. Yeah. That may have been a little bit from taking
her eye
off. That's
right. Eamon was going for majority, and he ended up eventually.
2002, I believe.
Yeah, there was an interesting interview actually with a Republican leader who tries to raise money for legislative races on Morning Edition this morning. And he's talking about what happens at the bottom of the ticket. I think an important thing to note, Christine, is, you know, we always talk about votes mattering. We talk about them mattering more. That doesn't necessarily mean people are going to turn out in a midterm election year. However, when you're talking about the balance of the state legislature, I mean, some of these races, they come down to a couple dozen votes. I mean, if there's anything that matters, it is actually some of these races where you could get 20, 25, 100 votes separating two of these candidates, including people who, you know, didn't think that they'd be seriously challenged at all by somebody.
Well, yeah, I think in 2016 we saw Speaker of the House Joe Arisimowitz, who's very popular, you know, only squeak by with an election win of something like 300 votes. So a lot of these races are close, and the margins are close right now in the House and the Senate between the parties.
Well, and very quickly before we take a break, Paz, I mean, in terms of the linkage between any sort of a top of the ticket, Bob Stefanowski at the top of the Republican ticket, Ned Lamont at the top of the Democratic ticket, as we'll talk about in just a little bit, there's probably not this enormous wave of enthusiasm from either party for either of those particular people. I don't know how much they're connected with any of the down ticket races. What is the factor of these gubernatorial candidates on these state legislative races?
The Democrats have more of a coordinated campaign. They always do. You got Chris Murphy's organization that is helping in that regard. You have Joe Biden coming in Friday to sort of rev up the troops. Johanna Hayes, who is sort of the candidate of the moment, the congressional candidate in the 5th District, is exciting the base, the Democratic base. But yeah, you have this emphasis on suburban women potentially being decisive, but yet in the Democratic cities, both in Connecticut and from what I'm reading nationally, there seems to be something of an enthusiasm gap. So that's why this is, as we'll get to in a moment, it's a close race for governor.
Which is one thing very quickly. We've talked almost exclusively about the Senate here. I mean, the House is probably in play, too. It's really, really hard to call these races and to predict these races. Themis Claridis, who would like to be Speaker of the House, has put a lot of energy statewide into seeing if she can help Republican candidates get there. But, I mean, I think for all of us, it's a harder thing. There's a bigger gap that has to be closed, and these races do come down to dozens of votes.
I was just going to say that I don't see that Bob Stefanowski has been appearing very often with the rest of the ticket. He kind of right or at all, not even with his lieutenant governor candidate. So there doesn't seem to be a lot of partnership there.
I know, Christine, you're not on the radio all the time. You're on the radio with us, but you've just provided a very important radio segue for us into the next segment.
Thank you.
Stefanowski, appearing or not appearing places. We're going to be talking about that and other things in the governor's race coming up next with Christine Stewart, editor-in-chief of CTNewsJunkie.com, Mark Pazniokas, Capital Bureau Chief of the Connecticut Mirror, Colin McEnroe, host of the Colin McEnroe Show, here in the Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. You can join our conversation at WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, where we're very active, at WNPR Wheelhouse. You can also call us at 860-275-7266 as we pull apart some of the political news of the week with Mark Pazniokas, Capital Bureau Chief of the Connecticut Mirror, Christine Stewart, Editor-in-Chief of CTNewsJunkie.com, and our own Colin McEnroe. Colin, what's on your show today?
So we've discovered that there are competitions for everything under the sun. A long time ago, we covered the fact that there are international and national whistling competitions. There apparently are also pun competitions. Now, John Oliver said that puns are not only the lowest form of humor, the lowest form of human activity. Puns have a bad reputation. On the other hand, like Groucho Marx did a lot of puns, you know? I mean, in Alabama, the tusks are looser is a pun. So we're going to talk about puns today.
We're talking about puns this afternoon at 1 o'clock on the Colin McEnroe Show. Here's what we've been talking about over the course of the last couple of weeks here on Where We Live with Lucy Nalpathanchil. She's had a great series of interviews lined up with the candidates. This goes back to the beginning of Where We Live when we invited in candidates to top offices and give you a chance to answer questions from them. Oz Griebel and Rod Hanscom had appeared last week. Ned Lamont is scheduled for Friday. On Monday, Mark Stuart Greenstein is scheduled. Now, for tomorrow, Bob Stefanowski was scheduled to be on the program. His campaign had confirmed with us. And as of yesterday, we called just to reconfirm and make sure he was coming. And they said they're not going to come. Here's a little bit of the statement that I just got from Kendall Maher, his campaign spokesperson, who says by Tuesday of next week, Bob will have appeared in 5 debates, in addition to countless forums and media interviews, especially through radio. Taking into account the substantial amount of time we have spent on radio so far in this campaign, we've decided to prioritize getting Bob on the road to make his case directly to voters in the closing days of the campaign. He told us he was going to do this. He canceled on us. And Colin, this honestly hasn't happened to our little program Where We Live before in quite this way. It's a little disappointing, I'll say, but I don't know what your thoughts are on this.
Yeah, I mean, it's one thing to say you don't want to do it. This time he said he wanted to do it. And then as far as I could tell, he didn't even really tell us he wasn't going to do it. We had to kind of go and find out from him because it wasn't on his schedule anymore. I don't get Bob Stefanowski. I'm just going to say that. I don't understand. I mean, I've covered some bad candidates. I've covered some pretty useless candidates. I've never covered a candidate for governor who shows so little interest in doing just the baseline things that you've got to do for running for governor. This is part of a pattern. I mean, he wouldn't go to the New London Day for that meeting. I mean, he probably wasn't going to get their editorial endorsement anyway. But there's like a lot of things you just kind of do because it's part of suiting up for the game. And he just doesn't want to do it. And I think one of the reasons he doesn't want to do something like a 49-minute public radio interview is he doesn't know the answers to 2/3 of the questions he's going to be asked. He's an underprepared candidate. He makes a lot of gaffes because if you get very much outside his range of, I'm going to eliminate the income tax, although I would recommend Mark Pazniokas' current story about whether he really is going to eliminate the income tax. But if you get very far outside that sphere, you know, he starts to falter. So, I mean, that's one reason anyway he doesn't want to do stuff like this.
But before I turn to our other panelists who've been following him on the campaign trail and would have a little bit more insight, I suppose, into, you know, how he acts with the press, whether or not he shows up at things he's going to show up with, let me push back a little, Colin, and say that some things that have changed are, I think a Bob Stefanowski campaign can look at a Donald Trump campaign and say, well, he's never done things the way that people expected, and he's been very successful. I think he can also look a little closer to home at someone like Jody Rell, who famously was never available to the press, who didn't give long-form interviews, who didn't really espouse any sorts of positions on anything most of the time, but she retired from that office as one of the most popular governors in the history of Connecticut. And I think that one might look at that and say, Why do you need the press? Why do you need to go on, you know, stupid public radio and talk to people?
Well, maybe you don't. And yes, Donald Trump doesn't give press conferences as president, really. But he's discovered that he is a publisher, right? He publishes every day. He tweets. And he has millions of people paying attention to his tweets. So he has really discovered a way to go around the press. I would say that Jody Rell is a little bit different. She's somebody who had been in the legislature, been lieutenant governor, and then kind of came into her position at a time of crisis in the state of Connecticut. She wasn't initially elected governor, although she did win an election for governor. And yeah, she had that particular style that was pretty passive and a little bit on the reclusive side and included not really liking to come into Hartford that much to work here. She was maybe cut a lot of slack for that because she was the person repairing the John Rowland wound. Stefanowski's a little bit different. I mean, he hasn't even really lived in Connecticut very much. He certainly has no record of public service. I'm not sure he ever coached Little League. I think it's at least fair, maybe he doesn't need us, but it's fair for us to say we need to know even more about you than we might need to know about certain candidates who have voting records and things like that that we can examine.
Christine?
Yeah, I think that he gets a little frustrated with some of the questions that we ask and the continued prodding over how he's going to pay for this tax cut. And I don't think that we have any answers yet. It is frustrating to me personally to not be able to have access to a candidate. I was given one opportunity for an interview, and that's been about it.
That's been about it. And Paz, I know that you were able to sit down with the candidate for some time, and you do have a piece out this morning, and I want to talk about the content of that piece in just a moment. But to talk a bit about this candidate and sort of the role he's playing here with the media, how he's conducting this campaign. Is it completely out of the ordinary? Does it just feel that way right now?
Couple things. First off, I want to disagree with you actually about Jody Rell. I don't think Jody Rell did a lot of stuff outside the building, but within the Capitol, she was accessible. She would sit down with you for, a half hour, 45 minutes, even, an hour. And she certainly kept up the tradition of having, at the very least, monthly press conferences.
Most of the state is actually outside of the building.
No, I understand, but much of the press that covers government
exactly
is in there. And I just want to make that point because it's also part of the tradition in Connecticut. In good times and in bad times, governors of Connecticut tend to be accessible to at least the Capitol press corps. Whether they go out and about is a whole other thing. Malloy is the extreme example. No matter what was happening in his life, the man was accessible. He would stand and answer questions. He engages on issues. John Rowland, even as he was kind of circling the drain, you could still talk to him. Bill O'Neill, who was never comfortable with the press, still made it a point to say this is part of the gig. Lowell Weicker certainly as well. So if Bob Stefanowski is elected governor, that's a major question as to how he interacts. Now, for whatever reason, I have had some success in getting him to sit down. Sometimes there has been comedy involved. My last interview, I was supposed to meet him in three different places and ended up, having an hour with him in the lobby of WTIC Radio after he did a
Radio?
He does radio.
I didn't realize.
I know.
It
hurts.
AM.
Well, he's going to be on tomorrow. I just so you know, his public schedule says he's going to be on an FM station that broadcasts out of Montauk and in Eastern Long Island. So he's also going to be in parts of Connecticut with that. Lee Elsie, I believe, is the host. Anyway,
yes,
sorry.
And he actually was the moderator for a Republican debate. And it's interesting because Lee is kind of a loose cannon. He was fun at that forum. He was the one who got them all on the record about Donald Trump, and you could see the Republicans in the room just going, "Oh God!" But I think Stefanowski's campaign has been very careful about not having him in a lot of long form interview formats because, I had this direct exchange with him about his lack of knowledge on things once he goes off topic on taxes and the economy. And, he's acknowledged. I mean, he's an unusual candidate. He was living in Europe for much of the past decade. So I've never seen a candidate like him, where you have somebody who did not vote for 16 years, who did not appear to read Connecticut media while he was away, and then comes back. And he wants to run the state. So, I mean, we just haven't had that.
Well, so how much of this is the question I've been trying to answer in my own head. How much of this is actually strategy and how much of this is he doesn't know because he hasn't been here and he hasn't been involved. And
he has the same senior advisor that Linda McMahon had in 2012. And you know, it's not exactly the same. But there's an element of that. They were very careful about where they would put Mrs. McMahon, which I think was a mistake because I think she actually was a pretty able candidate.
If they had taken the handcuffs off, she would have been fine.
We should say they were not literal handcuffs.
No,
yeah, no, not literal.
It's not a WWE thing.
Sorry.
Although, but here's the thing: Linda also had gaffes, and they were gaffes on not tricky things. I mean, I played a role in one of them. I mean, she was accepting an endorsement of a group, and I asked the obvious question because I had spent all of 10 minutes on their website seeing what is their agenda. So I asked her, do you agree with, you know, the fact that this group wants to repeal the federal minimum wage? They would like to repeal the Americans with Disabilities Act. And she fumbled, you know, and it was one of those moments where, you know, she got pummeled after that by labor, and it was, I don't know that she ever quite recovered.
What about these recent videos, too?
I just wanted to say one thing about the Linda McMahon thing, because there's an important difference that we should never lose sight of. If Linda McMahon had gotten elected to the Senate, or this goes for Johanna Hayes in Congress, too, you don't even really get to do that much your first year. You listen to leadership. You can have a few pet projects. If there's a leadership gap, you might get a subcommittee chairmanship, I mean, but that's unusual. You don't do that much, and it doesn't matter that there are huge gaps in your knowledge because basically you're not even going to be encouraged to be super knowledgeable about things. When you're the governor from day one, 20 issues drop on your desk on a daily basis, and they are not all fiscal issues. You have to fill superior court judge seats. You have to make decisions about transportation, education, the environment. I mean, it goes on and on. It's a multitasking job that requires a fairly broad level of expertise, and there aren't a lot of things you can just duck. If you're new in Congress, you can duck the stuff that you don't know about or go ask somebody. Much harder to do that as a governor.
Well, let's just actually talk about something you mentioned earlier, Christine, and that Paz has written about this morning, sort of ducking these questions about how he is going to repeal the income taxes. As you talk more to Bob Stefanowski or take a look at his website or listen to what he says on the campaign trail, it becomes fairly clear that what it sounds like he's saying is, I'm going to repeal the income tax, and isn't that a good thing for you? But what plays out is that over the course of time, perhaps if the economy improves enough, we may start in a couple of years to think about repealing parts of the income tax. That's a very different thing.
It is a very different thing. So he says that he's not going to do any of this in his first 2 years in office. And so, you know, he doesn't necessarily, there's obviously an immediate crisis. We do have over the first 2 years, a $4.6 billion deficit that we have to fill. But even beyond that, you know, his plan includes these so-called revenue triggers, and that, you know, we won't go forward and repeal taxes if we don't meet these revenue triggers. Well, what are those revenue triggers? He won't define the revenue triggers, and he won't say, you know, where he's going to cut spending to make up for any of these tax cuts, whether it be the corporate income tax or the estate tax.
The triggers, I mean, broadly are, he's basically saying more revenue is going to have to come in based on economic growth.
Where's that revenue going to come from?
But one of the fundamental problems with his plan, so let's say Connecticut gets lucky, the next governor gets lucky, and the economy starts to boom. Well, if you have reduced or eliminated the income tax, if you have reduced or eliminated the corporations tax, because that's also in the plan, and you're not going to expand the sales tax. So even if the economy is booming, what is the mechanism by which the state of Connecticut captures its share of that wealth?
Yeah, if you have lower income tax rates and that helps the economy boom, the assumption would be that there is still some sort of way to collect the revenue from that boom. If it's not going to be in sales taxes, it's not going to be in corporate taxes, it's not going to be in income taxes, the money does have to come from somewhere, and that is really unclear.
There's another basic question. He keeps talking about everything was great before 1991. Well, one of the things that's unclear, are you talking about rolling things back to 1991? Because if you are going to do that, people forget. Connecticut did have an income tax in 1991. It was a tax on income from interest and dividends and capital gains. And guess what, folks? It was 7% for capital gains, and it was 14% on interest and dividends. And the sales tax was 25% higher. It was 8%. So how exactly would you roll, you know, if, again, we're going to roll back to 1991, are you going to raise these other taxes? Right now he's saying no, because that's a bad political message. One of the other points of my story today is he's in this messaging kind of dilemma. So Ned Lamont and the Democrats, they look at what happened in Kansas, the last state that tried to do this kind of experiment, and they said, well, this is what happened in Kansas. You know, education spending got cut. There was no spending on roads. And they are applying all that to Bob Stefanski's plan, even though Bob's saying, I'm not going to make these cuts in the taxes unless we meet certain conditions. Okay. But his messaging problem is he has been stressing since December, I am going to eliminate the sales tax, I mean the income tax, in 8 years, over 8 years. It's a hard messaging thing to then pivot and say, no, you got to read the fine print here. And none of this may happen if certain conditions aren't met. That's kind of a lousy campaign issue. It may be a better intellectual exchange.
Well, and it feels like nobody understood history here. So let's understand, let's go back to how Weicker was able to get the income tax passed. In order to get the income tax passed, he said, look, I'm going to lower the capital gains and you know, I'm going to lower the sales tax. And that's how he's got his buddies to agree to voting in favor of the income tax.
They were not his buddies.
Well, yes. Well,
the people at the time, Colin.
Ask your physician if eliminating the income tax is right for you. So the other part of this is, okay, so what is he going to do for the first 2 years? And the answer is he's supposedly going to get under the hood, right? So one of the things he says all the time is, does anybody doubt that I can cut 5% of waste and fraud out of the budget?
Yes.
Yeah, and I think I would raise my hand and say, yes, I do. And not only that, but that's $1 billion, right? 5% is $1 billion of the state budget. So show me $100 million right now. We'll let you ride on the $900 million until you get in there. But if there's no question at all, none whatsoever, that you can cut 5% of waste and fraud, you ought to be able to show me right now $100 million of waste and fraud. Name the departments. Tell me what it is. And then you can get in there and do the other
$900 million. Well, and his answer on that literally is, trust me.
Yeah,
which Oz Griebel called him on during the debate.
And look, in fairness to yes, Bob Stefanski and every candidate who's ever been running for governor looking at a huge shortfall, if you give a detailed plan on what you're going to cut, you cannot be elected because you create enemies and you do not create supportives. However, to your point, this seems to be even a little bit vaguer than general. Now, you know, Ned Lamont is not putting on any great detailed plan either. And I wrote the same lead, I think, after three debates that we had an hour with these guys and we didn't learn anything more about how they intend to close a $2 billion hole in the first year.
Well, let's turn quickly before we have to take a break, Christine, to Oz Griebel. And you've written about, you know, whether or not Oz Griebel and his most recent showing in this Hearst, Connecticut SHU poll, he's sort of back down to 8.4%. He was up to 11%, which got him into last week's debate. When asked on stage about economic plans, it's pretty clear that Ned Lamont says what he says. It's fairly vague. He's going to do something about our property taxes. Bob Stefanski says something fairly vague. He's going to do something about our income taxes. Oz Griebel seems to be the only candidate saying, look, it's not that easy. And I'm not sure how exactly that resonates with people, but he's not saying, here's what I'm going to do to cut your taxes, because I think he understands that it's nowhere near as simple as the two other candidates are making it seem.
Yeah, I mean, you know, his plan is, hey, we're going to take this $2 billion we have in the rainy day fund. We're not going to make the...
It's a billion. It's only a billion.
Well, it's estimated to go up to $2 billion by the end of the year. take that money, put it towards the deficit and not fund the pensions and figure out how we can get either the lottery or some sort of the sale of state buildings into the pension fund. But that's a fairly specific proposal that he offers. You know, I don't know how much support he has outside of the Hartford area, but, you know.
But it's a fairly specific proposal based on, like, actual numbers of things that you could do as opposed to anytime you talk about economic growth spurring revenue triggers that are going to lead to my cutting the income tax to.
Well, and Oz will tell you, no, look. You cannot run the state like a business.
Well,
and
let's
anyone
actually,
who says that is.
Let's listen to a little bit from his debate. He talks about this.
Cannot run the state of Connecticut like a business. With all due respect, business principles can be applied, household principles can be applied. But you can't outsource an agency to India. You can't eliminate unprofitable customers. That's not what governors do. Governors have to fill, government has to fill the void that private sector can't fill. The private sector is a great ally in identifying ideas as to how to get that done. But the idea that you can run government like a business is preposterous.
Yeah, and so there he is, Christine. Right. He's saying that thing when asked and, you know, when confronted with Bob Stefanowski or Ned Lamont's plans.
And after that, Bob Stefanowski said, he was like, I can't believe that Oz Griebel just said you can't run the state like a business. He was just mind blown.
Well, I don't know, Colin. I mean, I think this is a key part of all this. We always have business candidates who are going to run and say that we're going to run government more like a business and it'll work better. Government isn't a business, clearly. Is there some point to be made that it could be run more like a business than it is?
Well, I mean, there is probably some point to be made about that. But, I mean, to say that I'm going to run it like a business, I thought Oz framed it pretty well. I mean, look, caring for the developmentally disabled is probably not, like, a super profitable thing to do. It's, you know, I mean, and you like all services that the state delivers, they probably want to do it at the leanest, most minimal level without completely shortchanging this population that they're mandated to serve. But you can't make a decision, well, that particular arm is not working very well. It's lop it off, which is one of the things that you do in business. I just want to say one thing about Oz, and I thought Christine's article today was excellent. You know, he's floating somewhere between 8 and 11, so he's decided to run as the grown-up, because he is a grown-up, too, and he's being more grown-up than the other two candidates, and he's not dwelling in fantasy land that much. I think he's got nothing to lose by doing that, and I stood up and clapped when he said the thing about you can't run the government like a business. You know, thank you for saying something like that. But I think newsrooms are very unreliable indicators of, like, who can get elected and who's going to get more votes. I mean, Bruce Babbitt would be president of the United States if, you know, the people that the press liked were really viable candidates. And Oz may be somewhere around his ceiling already. I don't know how much more he can build on what he's got. And the mere fact that we're impressed with his level of maturity means probably very, very little out there in election land.
For people who haven't read your piece, Christine, take people through the path to victory for Oz Griebel, if there is one.
You know, I don't know if there is a path to victory. So, and I guess these two political scientists I spoke to don't believe that there's really a path to victory. The question then becomes, who does Oz Griebel then spoil? Does he spoil Ned Lamont or does he spoil Bob Stefanowski? And so there seems to be a growing consensus that he's probably going to peel away voters from Ned Lamont and not as much Bob Stefanowski, even though he was a Republican in 2010.
Pass.
In the Hartford area, definitely. I think he takes more away from Ned Lamont than he does. Downstate, I've talked to people who think he probably hurts Stefanowski a little bit more. But again, it's at the margins. There is no discernible path to victory for Ned Lamont. He would have needed...
For Oz Griebel.
I'm sorry. Yes, for Oz Griebel. Thank you for that correction.
Again, Paz was up very late last night. It was game one of the World Series, yes. Fenway Park.
Eduardo Nunez is not his running mate.
No. No.
But so no path to victory for Oz and potentially peeling some voters away from Ned up here.
Because people know him more. I think they view him as a moderate. There's a lot of overlap with Ned Lamont. Not a lot. There is some overlap with Ned Lamont's message. They are both open to the idea that some form of tolling may be necessary in our future. Now, Ned has tried to tightly focus that on trucks, geared to out-of-state stuff, which may or may not be legal, probably not. Rhode Island is litigating that now. So, you know, and they both call it more reasonable in assessing, did Dan Malloy do anything right over 8 years? And they both said, yeah, they agree with his criminal justice policies. They agree with his policies on fighting homelessness. Bob Stefanowski, I think you could put a gun to his head and he's not going to say Dan Malloy did X right. You know, it's just not going to happen.
So I think that Oz Griebel is also being seen, though, as viable, too, because I think Bob Stefanowski is attacking him in his latest ad. So I think, you know, as much as, you know, we can discern from that.
There's another strategy there, though. He wants Ned and Oz to be seen as a unit. And that's not bad strategy. I don't know that it means viability, that he sees him as viable. I think he wants to, in a hyper close race,
paint them as the same.
Remember, this is a state that's had incredibly close gubernatorial races. So I think that's what it's about. It's they know they got to fight for every issue, and they want unaffiliated to view Oz as a different version of Ned.
Well, and there's so many undecideds in this race. That's what I was going to say. I mean, like 15%, 19%. I mean, a ton of undecided voters still.
Yeah, we're playing a guessing game right now, and we really don't know. I mean, this is the old cliche, but turnout is going to be a huge factor. I feel as though, like, the one thing I feel confident about saying is that women are going to vote in larger numbers in this election than they typically do in a midterm. That would seem to favor Lamont, who in every single poll has, you know, quite a gender gap advantage there. Typically, in a situation like this, I don't know if this is a typical situation, but typically, Stefanowski would need a lot more unaffiliated votes than Lamont would, because there just aren't enough Republicans to keep you going. So, you know, if Griebel begins to bleed from both of them, which clearly is what he's going to do, Lamont could probably absorb a little bit more of a bleed than Stefanowski. Stefanowski needs every unaffiliated vote he can get.
But yet he won't be appearing on Where We Live, a place where a lot of unaffiliated voters are going to be listening tomorrow at 9 o'clock. So we'll have more updates coming up on the Where We Live Twitter feed and probably on Facebook today, trying to let you know who exactly is going to be talking on tomorrow's show. It came as a bit of a shock to us, and it's a little upsetting because we had a show planned. Dan Labonte will be on Where We Live with Lucy Nalpathanchel answering your questions on Friday. Oh, you want to come on? maybe Colin and I will come on, make a guest appearance on Where We Live tomorrow. Colin McEnroe, who is running a pun contest on the Colin McEnroe Show, is with us. Also, Christine Stewart, editor-in-chief of CTNewsJunkie.com. Mark Pazniokas, Capitol Bureau Chief at the Connecticut Mirror. When we come back, a quick conversation about somebody very involved in state politics and in healthcare getting caught in a revolving door. That tends to hurt, doesn't it? This is The Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. You can join our conversation at wnpr.org/thewheelhouse. And you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. Joining us is Colin McEnroe, host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Christine Stewart from CTNewsJunkie.com and Mark Pazniokas from the Connecticut Mirror. He's the Capitol Bureau Chief there. Both Christine and Paz have great stories out in their publications today about the governor's race, which we've been talking about. Maybe we'll loop back on that a little bit. But I want to turn to something else that's important that we talk about periodically in the show, the state revolving door law. It has this law on the books to try to keep public officials from jettisoning immediately to a job at a private company that was involved in dealings before the state agency that they work for. This week, former Access Health CT CEO James Wadley acknowledged he may have violated the law. That admission came in a statement announcing his resignation from a company that he joined only about 3 weeks ago. So, Christine, explain this a little bit to us. So, Jim Wadley, well known as the head of Access Health CT, takes this other job and almost immediately says, no, I probably shouldn't have done that.
Back in February that he called the Office of State Ethics and said, you know, 10 days before he announced that he was going to be resigning his position as CEO of Access Health, that, you know, hey, I might be doing this and here, what are the ethics laws? But he didn't actually officially resign until April. And then it was the year before in September, he had inked a deal with a kind of a software company that was administrating their shop program for the exchange, and it was about a $2 million contract. And you know, he was the one who signed the contract and inked the deal, and then he went to go work for the company. So that's a no-no.
What? Let me just ask, and we can't get inside his head, and I know that we've reached out to him to talk on the news side. Harry Jones has been covering this. Why would anyone think that that is something you could do? Like, why is it even possible to imagine that that's okay?
I don't know. I honestly don't know. I'm not in his head. I don't know. I think he thought that he wasn't violating ethics laws by waiting until October to announce this new job. You know, so clearly he misread them and had a misunderstanding of them.
I think that the question is there's the letter of the law and there's the spirit of the law, Paz. And I think the spirit of the law, when we're talking about revolving door, is really that we don't have people writing contracts, executing contracts, certainly in this world of quasi-public state agencies, which I know Colin will love to talk about in just a moment, agencies that straddle between public and private. They have some of the oversight of the public, but not entirely. I mean, if you're in a job like that, it seems pretty clear that the spirit of it is you don't go cash in with someone who you're working with on the for-profit side.
The fact there was a significant contract let is really what kind of brings us the attention of Christine and this station. Because, you know, there's a lot. I think the revolving door statute does not get a good look, you know, very often. But usually it's because it's a lower level person and there wasn't a lot of money on the table before you left. Now, I'm not suggesting that Mr. Wadley did anything that was corrupt, but there is a question of confidence in government. And again, if you are involved with giving business to a company, you're going to get you should get a hard look if you end up working for that company in less than a year, and that's sort of the standard here. It's a pretty simple standard. There are some things about Connecticut ethics laws which I think are very weak, particularly when it comes to the General Assembly. What is tolerated as far as a conflict, but this one should be pretty black and white.
The fine is pretty hefty. The fine is $10,000 for the person and then $10,000 for the company that hired them. And that's if it wasn't a willful thumbing of the nose.
It cost him his job. I mean,
yeah, and it cost him his job.
Christine,
yeah.
Do we know exactly what the original ethics opinion told him?
There was no original ethics opinion. He called.
Yeah.
And the ethics attorney talked to him on the phone, and they logged the call. And the call said he called, and he talked about he wanted to know about this statute and the statute and the statute.
Yeah. So there's nothing in writing. We don't really know.
No, there's nothing in writing.
Because one of the problems, the people from the Office of Ethics, they're great people. I know some of them, but you know, there's like, I don't know how many stories have we covered where like somebody said, well, I got an opinion from the Office of Ethics about whether I could kill this guy, you know, and they said, sure, it's not a big problem, you know.
Official opinion. It was just
the opinions,
the conversation.
It turns out you're just allowed to do, at least based on the opinion you got from the ethics office beforehand. It's kind of amazing. I'll say, like you asked the question, you know, why did he think this was okay? I think one reason he might have thought it was okay is because it's pretty much, unfortunately, the way the world works these days. And we just turn our eyes for 2 seconds to the drama unfolding in Washington around the death of Jamal Khashoggi, where it turns out like everybody's working for the Saudis. I mean, the point man in Washington for the Saudis is Norm Coleman, the guy that Al Franken beat for the Senate seat in Minnesota, and then like everybody else, Haley Barber, just everybody else is working for the Saudis. And so, I mean, unfortunately, this is the way the world works. That you get out of office and you look around and you try to figure out, you know, how you can line your pockets, how you can ultimately reap that final benefit of having, you know, been either an elected representative or something. And yeah, there's some good rules about you not being able to do it, but the opportunities to do it exceed those.
We have less than a minute, so quick thought.
Well, you
do
have an expertise in a certain area. You can end up in that industry. So, right. I mean, that's sort of endemic.
I mean, those were his skills. But at the same time, I thought it was odd when, you know, he resigned and he told me he was resigning. And I was like, oh, you must have another job lined up. Where are you going to go work? And he didn't have an answer.
He didn't have an answer. It's a story to be continued. Christine Stewart's been covering it for ctnewsjunkie.com. Thank you, Christine.
Thank you.
And thanks to Mark Pazniokas, Capitol Bureau Chief at the Connecticut Mirror. Thank you, Paz.
Go Sox.
Go Sox. And Colin McEnroe, host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Thank you, Colin.
Alex Cora has psychic powers.
The Wheelhouse is produced by Scott Brady, who also has psychic powers. He could have told us that Bob Stefanowski wasn't going to come on the show tomorrow. Katie Tolarski is our executive producer. Kion Wolf is our technical producer. Thanks to Carlos Mejia, who is our technical producer. Benina Beattie helped out with the show as well. You can go to WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. We'll be back next week. Thanks so much for joining us.
This is Connecticut Public.